Welcome to our podcast on the magic of conversation and the evolution of ideas. This podcast is brought to you by the International Academy for Leadership, known by its German acronym IAF, located in the German town of Boomerspark. The Academy trains leaders working for partner organizations of the Frederick Naumann Foundation for Freedom all over the world. It brings together experts, opinion leaders, and committed young liberals and aspiring leaders to share specific experiences, knowledge, and most importantly, conversations to develop liberal solutions to public policy challenges. Well, in today's episode, what we did was have a very, very fascinating conversation with Deirdre Nansen McCloskey. She is the senior fellow and holds the Isaiah Berlin Chair of Liberal Thought at Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. from 2015 at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She has been Distinguished Professor Emerita of Economics of History and Professor Emerita of English and of Communication. She's been trained at Harvard in the 1960s as an economist. She's written 25 books and edited 9 more and has published some 500 articles on economic theory, economic history, philosophy, rhetoric, statistics, feminism, ethics, law, and liberalism. She's taught for over 12 years at the University of Chicago in the economics department during its glory days and now describes herself as a literary, quantitative, postmodern, free market, progressive, Episcopalian, ex-Marxist, Midwestern woman from Boston who was once a man. Her most popular recent books are Why Liberalism Works and How True Liberal Values Produce a Freer, More Equal, Prosperous World for All in 2019, and with Art Carden, Leave Me Alone and I'll Make You Rich, The Bourgeoisie Deal in 2020. She's very famous for her trilogy of bourgeoisie equality, how ideas and not capital or institutions enrich the world, bourgeoisie dignity, why economics can't explain the modern world, and the bourgeoisie virtue ethics for an age of commerce. This treatise and her subsequent writing looks forward to a world of universal dignity and prosperity created by liberal innovism. And that's one of the topics that we are going to be exploring in this podcast today. Where we have a fascinating opportunity today, it is absolute an honor and a privilege to have Professor Deirdre McCloskey with us today. We are going to pick your brains as much as we can on very, very interesting conversations on things that you have written about, you have talked about in the past. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Thank you. So let's start off the conversation with a very, very interesting point that you bring up multiple times in your publication, and you've talked about this quite extensively. I want to explore this a little bit further with you. It's the idea of this unprecedented growth that happened in the 1800s.
Yeah.
And you sort of reject certain conditions that have been put forward by orthodoxy economists.
That's right.
You reject that capitalism or institutions or what we call good institutions. On the other side, there are, of course, like explanations of, oh, this is all colonial extraction.
Yes.
Or this came out of war efforts and so on and so forth.
Or slavery.
Yeah, or slavery. So these are all these explanations that have been put forward on why the West certainly, you know, made this huge leap forward in terms of growth in real per capita income and pulled millions of people out of poverty. And you put forward a very, very interesting alternative explanation. Mm-hmm. Can you go into this a little bit? What is exactly your explanation? Why do you reject whatever has been put forward by, I would very much claim, by orthodox economists?
Yes. Oh, yes. And from the right and from the left and from the middle.
Exactly.
They're all wrong. I'm right. My theory is correct. All the others, they made a mistake. My theory is that it's liberty that created the modern world. And people say, well, that can't be. That's just an idea. But I think it's ideas. As John Maynard Keynes said, madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribbler a few years back. And it's ideas that change. And I've argued in three very long books that it's basically in the 1700s in Northwestern Europe. There had been earlier possibilities in Osaka in Japan and here and there, but there hadn't ever been a large society which said to people, you go do what you want, pretty much. Move where you want. Mobility is the poor man's innovation. It's extremely important. In the 19th century, of course, there's a tremendous with improvements in ocean transport. Mobility is how most of our ancestors improved themselves. But starting a business, which in many countries now is extremely hard. In a country that I admire and love, South Africa, it takes months to go through various official forms to start a business enterprise. In the 18th century in France, before it turned, it itself turned liberal, I always stutter on my favorite word, to make any innovation in France, now this sounds bizarre, but it happened. You had to go through a committee in Paris. If you were going to build a new water mill, not necessarily innovative, just you're going to put a new one on this place, you had they had to get the approval of these guys in Paris, which of course is a French habit right to the present. But in England, especially in Scotland, in the North American colonies of the English, you were allowed, you had what I call equality of permission. Equality of permission is the core of a free society.
Before we go, this is an interesting concept. Definitely you'd like to hear more about that.
Yeah, someday.
Just try to kind of like locate your ideas and the others that I bet us and others audience also have, because we've read about Max Weber talking about Protestant ethics.
Poor Max.
Poor Max. We have others. Poor Immanuel Kant, David Hume.
God got it wrong.
They argued it was the freedom that was necessary, but the competition between the small states that also created the flourishing that happened.
That worked in music. The great flowering of German music in the 18th century was precisely small states, the hundreds of small states in the German lands competing with each other to have the best orchestra. But on the other hand, in what they called the Cameralist theory, each little state had its customs barriers. So when it came in the 19th century, when Germany started to liberalize in its economy, slavery was abolished in Prussia in the early 19th, and not slavery, serfdom, the early 19th century, and the created what the Austro-Hungarian Empire already had, a large free trade area. So, but it's not material causes that made the modern world. It's not investment, which is what sort of the conservatives might say. Yes, it's these virtuous savers, and they're the ones who made us rich, the old theory of Rostow a long time ago, that said, increases in the savings rate, you get delta K, as we economists say, and that's what made us rich on the one hand. But at the other end of the conventional political spectrum, my friends on the left, I was once a socialist myself, say, ah, yes, it's exploitation. It's stealing that made the modern world. And the trouble with both of those is that investment and stealing have been going on for a long time.
I remember reading Marx, and he was arguing there was this initial capital accumulation.
That's
for
right.
English.
That's a crazy
the sheep idea. Farming.
Exactly, sheep eating men and so forth. And look, I was a Marxist once. I admired the master, and I'm fond of saying to my friends on the left, Marx was the greatest social scientist of the 19th century without compare. They say, yes, that's right. And he got everything wrong. They say, no, I hate you, Deirdre, go away. And then to my friends on the right, I say the same thing. And say, Marx got everything wrong. I start that way. Then I say, but he was the greatest social scientist of the 19th century. And they say, oh, we hate you, Deirdre. So that's why I haven't got any friends.
But one of the ideas there, I think the question is, why is Orthodox economics so stuck on this idea then? Because we keep hearing, we have latest books, Acemoglu, Johnson Robinson, Why Nations Fail.
I'm about to debate James Robinson at the University of Chicago in November. He and I are going to have it. Yeah, he and... Acemoglu, they think that it's very desirable to have a larger state. And this is despite the fact that 55% of French national income goes through the state. Well, what do we want? Do we want 85%? And that's kind of their line. In fact, Acemoglu has... written with Johnson at MIT in the same line. And it's this belief in planning.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Samuelson, the great economist at MIT, believed all his life that the Soviet Union, well, until it fell, was going to catch up to the United States very soon, 15 years. Now, it was always 15 years. It was 15 years in the 1950s, according to Samuelson, and 15 years in the 1980s, according to Samuelson, because he believed in planning. He, by the way, this is an important fact that you need to know about Paul Samuelson. He was my mother's longtime mixed doubles tennis partner. I didn't know Samuelson, so I don't call him Paul. He's Professor Samuelson, as far as I'm concerned. But look, in our own lives, we know that we have to plan. But you know, any adult should know that her plans often don't work out. Mm-hmm. That we make care, you know, all you have to do is take a look in my closet, maybe yours, to know the mistakes I've made.
I'm glad you're not referring to my closet. Thank you. But it reminds me of John Lennon famously saying, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans.
That's an excellent phrase. Is it a song? Is said in it, or just...
I would have to research that. It's attributed to John Lennon.
Yeah, it's a fine remark. And the great early liberal... You see, I stutter at it all the time. Robert Burns... in Scotland, his poem and song, A Man's a Man for All That, is a, this is 1795, is a statement of the principles that we advocate for him. But in another poem, he said, the best laid schemes of mice and men gang oft agley, which in Scots means often don't work.
So even if we take the example of 18th century England, there were all these restrictions in terms of private bills had to be introduced to make roads, which were turnpike roads, make canals. You had to get permission from the government. Sure. So despite that framework, you're arguing that people were really free. Is it just the mobility factor there then?
No, it's not only the mobility factor, although there was a law, the laws of settlement, which in fact were against the mobility of ordinary working people. And Adam Smith, a Scot, where they didn't have it, was eloquent against the he got furious. He didn't frequently get furious, but here he got furious about how terrible this was to impose on ordinary working people, to make them go home to their home parish if they were unemployed. But there was parliamentary permission to, say, have an enclosure act where you would disentangle the medieval complexity of farming and make it modern private property, as in some ways, by the way, it was even in the Middle Ages. But it was easy to corrupt Parliament. So, yes, you had to go to Parliament. You pay, as we say in the United States, you pays your money and you takes your choice. And that they were explicit about it. It was called the old corruption. And it was oil in the machinery. And it worked much better than not having oil. Putting sand in the machinery is not a good idea. And that was the tendency of across the channel in France to put sand in the machine. So, but it's very slow. I don't want to say that we Northwestern Europeans led the way in equality of permission instantly. After all, my own country was a slave economy until 1865. And with women couldn't vote until 1920, or is it 19? But anyway, 1920, except interestingly, in the western states of the United States, where they got the vote much earlier. So it was a slow progress, and blacks were being abused in the South especially, but also in the North. And there were immigration restrictions of an absurd sort, starting with the Oriental Exclusion Acts of the 1880s. So look, it's always a matter of working around the enthusiasm people have for interfering in other people's lives.
And you counter that with the term equality of permission. Earlier, I had rudely interrupted you when you were talking about it because I wanted to locate your ideas within the other ideas.
Sure.
But equality of permission, maybe you share a bit more about, because we think about equality of outcome, of course. We've heard about that a lot. Liberals tend to talk about equality of opportunities.
Yes.
You introduce equality of permission. What are you doing with this?
I can see that I'm not introducing it, that it's actually what the blessed Adam Smith, and this is a interview on the radio, so you can't see me crossing myself. I'm an Anglican. Every time I mention Adam Smith, I cross myself.
You have two witnesses here.
I think you just look at what he says, and he says that, but so did the French physiocrats, from whom he learned a lot in the early 18th century, and so did many of the Americans, the North American English colonies, though, again, there was this slavery problem. Abigail Adams John Adams's wife writes to him a famous letter while they're drafting the Declaration of Independence in 1776. And she says, you know, I hope you're not conceding to those damn Virginians with their slavery. And then she further said to him, and don't forget the ladies. I hope this new society that you're forming will give women rights. And it's certain that John just laughed and didn't do anything about it. So there was this tendency, I'll say, in American life, but in all kinds of countries, to interfere with other people's activities. But there's a tension between saying, yeah, you're allowed to do all that, but don't do that. Don't be gay. This was 100 years, Northern European, Protestant reign of terror against homosexual men. They didn't ever care about the females. They could go do what they wanted, but the men, they would jail for homosexuality and so on, and all kinds of things. Don't smoke marijuana. Don't do this. Don't do that. And yet, so there's both. There's this American, don't tread on me, that was one of the 18th century cries. Don't tread on me. We're tough. I can do whatever I want. I can bring my AK-47 to church if I want. So the hell with you, on the one hand. And then there's don't do that. Don't do that. Don't be an immigrant. And my grandmother, who was born in the 1890s, she had a very nice liberal motto. Now understand, it's the 1890s and early 1900s. There are still horses, lots of them. She said the motto should be, do anything you want, but don't scare the horses. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, a sensible view. And that, you know, the problem is that we keep inventing new regulations for everything. There was a study by the Mercatus Institute and of all outlets, the New York Times, which discovered that to run an apple orchard in New Hampshire, you had to follow 5,000 regulations. The regulations on ladders alone would reach halfway up an apple tree. So my proposal, and it's the liberal impulse all the way through, is to burn the regulations, most of them. Now, there are some that we should have. You shouldn't be allowed to put chalk in milk. You shouldn't be allowed to poison people, say. Good. If the Canadians invade, I can hardly sleep at night worrying about the Canadians invading the United States. If they take over Maine, state of Maine, they can have the northern part. I didn't really care about it. But when they get to Portland, I want the federal government to draft people to go fight the damn Canadians. So I'm not an anarchist. I believe we need government. But I do believe that we've gotten way out of line in protecting, is the phrase, some people, namely steel manufacturers,
yeah,
against the foreigners, or regulating apple orchards, or we've just gone completely nuts. As shows in the share of national income that now goes through various levels of government, from local to federal. In the United States, it's about 35%. In France, it's about 55%. And that's too much.
And these restrictions that you're talking about and that we are unhappy with in the liberal perspective, They are restricting access of people to opportunities, to power, to resources.
Patients. Look,
I'm still wondering, if I may ask, why do you prefer the term permission over opportunities? Isn't this all access opportunities? Why is permission a better term?
Because what people mean by equality of opportunities is that we'll tax you to give me an opportunity. Mm-hmm. That's what the framework is. The only we around is the state. And the state's going to give you an opportunity. And, you know, I'm not against publicly financed education necessarily, especially elementary education. That's probably a good idea. There's an alleged externality in having a lot of people who can't read. Although I should point out that the most educated country in the world between 1933 and 1945 went completely crazy. So it's not obvious that you get a good society by giving people advanced degrees in philosophy. But still, so there are some of these subsidies that I think are good, but not too many of them. I think we've gotten, and it's very easy for them to be corrupt. If instead of financing elementary education with taxes on you and me, we provide elementary education through taxes on you and me, that is, provide in state schools, the trouble is that there is a danger, which we can see in American education very plainly, of the trade unions or the large bureaucracies taking over to enrich the middle class, at least give the children of the middle class jobs. Once the New York City schools, elementary schools, had two large branches, 1/3 of the children were being educated, this is a long time ago, by the Catholic school system, and the other were the public schools. The central office of the New York public schools had 3,000 employees. In the office, 3,000 in various, the central administrative staff of the Catholic schools was 30 people.
Wow.
So let me get back to, because what you're describing in terms of, sure, there should be investment into certain things. Maybe it's a good idea.
Easy to corrupt, however.
Exactly. So then leave it easy to corrupt. I'm going back to thinking, well, Douglas North, pretty much in institutions, when he talks about open access societies, is describing a framework of, you know, how nations actually grew. Why is that explanation not, you know, does not explain human history the way we see it or human prosperity the way we see it?
Doug was a friend of mine, a wonderful man. Because he was a left-wing pacifist in the Second World War, he wouldn't fight in the army. Instead, he volunteered for the Merchant Marine in the Pacific, which was extremely dangerous. He was a courageous, wonderful man. He was a wine snob, spoke perfect French, but he had a kind of craggy Western American pretense that he put on. He was a charming man. Open access societies are liberal. It's making up another word in order to avoid admitting what's completely obvious, that the new political idea in the 18th century was liberalism. The new political ideas in the 19th century are statist in one way or another. Nationalism, socialism, trade unions. If you like those three, maybe you'll like Hitler's National Socialist Workers' Party. I just a thought. And Doug fell into this statist mentality, as do most of his many followers. Oh, we need the rules of the game. And who's to supply the rules of the game? L'État, the state. Well, to hell with that. Now, he was a free market guy, kind of. But as adopted by the World Bank, the policy is add institutions and stir, mm-hmm. right? The earlier formula at the World Bank that I was trained in as a student back in the 1960s was add capital and stir. Now they want to add institution and stir. Both cases, add. So Acemoglu and Robinson say add institutions and stir. And the trouble with Doug's way of looking at it is that it is this kind of, you could almost call it, but this won't help people much, a production function way of looking at it. A very important innovation in thinking in economics in the 1870s was to think in terms of what's called a production function. And that's sort of common sense. You've got to have inputs of capital and labor and land, and then you make stuff. Okay, that's good. It's an improvement over the thinking before. But the trouble is it forgot about the human spirit. It forgot that for institutions to work, or for, I don't know, the capital market to work or the labor market to work, humans have to, as it were, get along. And their attitudes they have to be for economic growth. They have to be, do anything you want, but don't scare the horses. And every time little pieces of that get implemented by governments, as in China or India, the economy starts growing like mad, having nothing to do with changes of institutions. You know,
what about the role of power in society? I mean,
well,
the permission, it's not just the state or the government that tries to reduce
permission, opportunities, is also power structures within societies, absolutely. Traditional absolutely. Leaders.
Well, the traditional ways of treating women, for example.
Exactly.
But they become, we're kind of, there it is, attitudes in Islam and in Orthodox or extreme Orthodox Islam and extreme Orthodox Judaism that all women should cover their arms because it tempts the poor dears, meaning the men. How sad. We've got to dress in, you know, things that cover all of us, or the men will become crazy. That is so irritating. But that becomes vicious. It's bad enough when it's in men's heads. And they're in... Of course, if they're enforcing it with a fist, then I want the state to intervene to stop them. I want crime to be stopped. We can't stop all crime, but that's to be stopped. So
so it's a justice system that is required.
It's a justice system, although most of protection from crime is private. We lock our front doors at night and so on. We avoid bad neighborhoods. We do it, not the state. But still, that's one place the state should intervene in the social customs. There's a wonderful story from Larage, from the British Empire in the 19th century in South Asia. This man says, but you know, this custom of throwing the widow of the man who's being cremated on the fire That's our custom. And the English official says, oh, gee, I understand that. I'm very sympathetic with this. You have your custom. But you know, we have a custom too. When someone murders someone, we hang them. So there are selected state interventions that make sense, but the problem comes when "don't do that" gets enforced by the state. In Southern Europe, during this period in which in Northern Europe gays were being jailed, in Southern Europe, it was against the church. The church didn't like it, although, of course, they were as gay as can be. But still, you know, no one was put in jail in France or Italy, Greece or Spain for being gay. So it's when the state gets, when there's clothing police, that's the problem.
It's very interesting in terms of, sure, we've talked about these principles, and you call it innervision.
Yeah, I do.
And so...
Not capitalism. The word capitalism is such a stupid word. I could go on for 10 minutes telling you what's wrong with this word. There you are.
But so, in general, with innervism, you've given us a great, you know, don't do anything until, like, you don't spook the horses. You can do anything until you spook the horses. So let's say that's the principle we follow. Yeah. A lot of our audiences are actually not academics, not philosophers.
Sure.
They're policy practitioners. Yeah. They're looking for solutions, saying, I believe in the principle of freedom.
Yeah.
I really want to promote this. What does it mean in terms of actual policies then?
Well,
what should we care about in policymaking?
You should consult the Cato Institute, where I work in Washington, and do everything they say.
But don't do anything else.
Don't do anything else. Just follow what we say. And our view is basically stop doing what you're doing. If you're at the bottom of a hole digging, the first thing to do is stop digging. So stop. The Biden administration didn't take off the tariffs that the Trump administration so stupidly imposed on, Chinese steel or something, because Biden is a conventional trade union Democrat and he believes in protection. And unfortunately, Kamala Harris, who I hope to God wins the election, she's also she's a lawyer, for one thing. And lawyers believe that the way forward is to add more laws. So, gee, we haven't got enough laws in the federal code, which, you know, goes from here to the other side of the room. We need more laws. No, we don't. We need to let people do anything they want, but don't scare the horses.
Right. So let's move on in our conversation, because another aspect of this, of what you've written quite a lot, you describe yourself as a Christian classical liberal.
I am.
And I'd like to explore a little bit if religion has ever historically played a part in promoting liberalism as an ideology. Is there a connection there?
No. And I've argued strongly against this. There is a kind of Eurocentric claim that somehow liberalism comes from Western Christianity. And this, I think, is just crazy. The Catholic Church, or for that matter, the Church, because before 1517 there was just one in the West, was not a liberal institution. Of course it wasn't. It was modeled on the administrative framework of the Roman Empire. It was a way of an absolute monarch called the Pope telling people what to do. So no, and in fact, as I understand it, there's much more chance that Buddhism, for example, would lead to a liberal society, a society in which people can do what they want within the constraint of not physically hurting other people. Incidentally, there's a widespread argument that saying nasty things hurts people, and you mustn't be allowed to do that. And I go with the children's rhyme, sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me. And that's about right. That's a liberal way of looking at that. So no, so it's a matter of staying with this deeply. But you know, look, the reason people think that there's a connection between Christianity and liberalism is the equality of souls, which is emphasized in Judaism and in Islam. Zoroastrianism, Buddhism, indeed, even in Hinduism, if you allow that eventually you'll stop being a cockroach and become a Brahmin. So they're, but equality of souls had absolutely no impact on secular society until in the 18th century, people started saying, oh yeah, as Thomas Jefferson wrote, all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator, blah, 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 blah. Sounds very Christian. 2 points. Tom was not a Christian. He was at best a vague deist. And two, he owned slaves, some of whom were his own children. So, yeah, that's very nice, Tom. Thank you for those wonderful phrases, but it's not coming from Christianity.
That's fascinating. I think where we are going with this questioning is for a lot of the world today, religion translates to character building, to virtue.
Yeah, I know it does. That's what they say.
Exactly. And so the question is then, if we remove in a secular society or say in the age of new atheists or new atheism in general, where it is science and evidence-based and so on and so forth,
yeah.
So who takes care of character building? How does this move forward?
I think it's an important point. I don't sneer at it. I'm not an atheist. I've not ever been an atheist. Till 1998, I was agnostic. Then I became an Anglican, and now I'm an Anglican. But and there is a character problem. As I said before, for a society to work, whether it works as a tyranny or as a free society, the ethic of people has to agree with it. People in China, for example, have made a deal with the Communist Party. You keep allowing us to grow by our individual efforts. There's this absurd idea that somehow central planning is the way China grows. No, it doesn't. It's because it adopted innovism on a large scale that it started to grow. Same thing's happening now in India. But the deal is the Communist Party doesn't allow you to have any other rights except economic rights. And that's a sad trade-off, but that it works shows how powerful this, even if not about the press or anything else in China, this innovistic liberty works. And that's a country with a tenuous connection with theistic religion. There are the 500 gods of the Han Chinese in general, and they, some of them once were Buddhists, but they kind of gave up that. It's a highly secular society.
So,
but there is a problem of character. It's got to be formed, but it has to be formed at your mother's knee. And it actually is formed at your mother's knee. This is a feminist point. The conservatives take it as, yes, we're going to enslave women to be bearers of children. We're going to socialize wombs, which is what the right in the United States now is proposing to do. No, but how you're raised, you can either raised to be obedient to the Communist Party, or you can be raised to say to hell with the Communist Party, and I favor the latter.
I just wanted to draw this parallel, and you have to correct me if I'm going in the wrong direction. What you are saying is we need certain rules. For example, you mentioned safety, so we protect ourselves by locking our doors, but we also
need just prudence.
But we shouldn't, yes, and we shouldn't have the government interfering, at least it should do at a minimal level, if possible, otherwise it's prone to corruption. Now, compare that to religion, and the parallel that I see is that people live their own values. These could be Christian, Islamic, Judaic values, live their own values. As soon as the church comes in with its attempt to control, it becomes an interference.
That's very important, because in other Abrahamic religions, the theory was, and often still is, that the government should have nothing to do with it. Islamic Spain, you know, the famous La Convivienza of the 9th, 10th, 11th century, Jews, Christians, whoever, became important people in the government, even. And in general, until rather recently, Islamic societies were more tolerant than the Christian societies. But after all, as I said a few minutes ago, the most educated country in the world embarked on the extermination of Jews in Europe. So it's the entanglement of the state and the religion. In 1744, in Saudi Arabia, there was an agreement between the state and the religious authorities, which has been foundational to the religious fascism of Saudi Arabia ever since. So, you know, there is a theory of equality of souls, but it stops meaning things when there's this mixture of the two. Yet, how we raise children matters. The family matters. Contrast Michelle Obama, a wholly admirable person in my opinion, raised on the south side of Chicago, an American black, by moderate income, sensible parents. Compare her character in life with that of Donald Trump, raised in Queens, New York, by foolish and very rich parents, where he's taught to look out for number one. Which life is more successful? Michelle Obama's are Donald Trump's. Now, Donald would say, oh, yeah, hey, I got a lot of money. He's much less money than he claims. But I got a lot of money. That shows that I'm the king of the roost. He's in a living hell called being Donald Trump. There's this famous story by Kafka, where the man wakes up one day and he's a giant insect, cockroach, say. And it's a very terrifying story. But imagine you woke up tomorrow and were Donald Trump. What an appalling failure of a family.
This is very, very interesting because we are starting from a premise of innovism. So we are talking about ideas, sure, the freedom of ideas, exactly, the freedoms of ideas to evolve, the evolution of ideas.
Evolution is the key. It's like biological evolution. Trial and error is how economies actually change. This is the problem with this production function mentality that I spoke of before. And it's the problem that Doug Norris and the institutionalists have. They have an idea of the input, you stick stuff in, and then out comes product. No, innovation comes from trying out stupid ideas, good ideas, and just like biological evolution, if you let it happen, that is equality of permission, you're off to the races, we say in the United States here. Things are going to work. And they do. It's happened over and over and over again.
Let's blame Cobb Douglas for derailing our research agenda.
That's right. That's exactly right. There was this conviction, and I could get into the technicalities of it. Some of my friends have been important innovators in this, but they don't get that it's individuals who innovate, which I find somewhat strange. Every innovation has to originate in someone's noggin, in their head, or their feet, if that's where they think. It's got to be an individual. Now, then they go out and they try to persuade other people and they get people to invest and blah, 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 blah. But investment by itself.
So it brings me to this research agenda, that another thing that you've been promoting to a certain extent of humanomics. If you can explain to us, how do we study humans then? How do we understand them better? And why do you think, what is the policy research agenda for humanomics?
Well, the humanomics simply means economics broader. It doesn't mean we throw away econometrics or math or something, because there are insights to be gotten that way. And it certainly doesn't mean we throw away economic theory. Thinking like an economist, paying a lot of attention to entry and exit and so forth, is that's how biologists think. To make evolution work, there's got to be entry and exit, or else species don't evolve. It's not against economics, it's to supplement economics. And how do you supplement it? By recognizing that people are people, and that they have poetry and songs, plays and social customs, loves and hates, that they're humans. And the result of this is not that the laws of economics are all changed and it's no longer true that when there's a profit opportunity, people take it. No, it's still true. But it deeply modifies how we think about ourselves. For example, jobs. I mean, it's perfect. I saw yesterday a weaver of a carpet in a factory in India. And this man spends his whole life tying knots. My friend said, well, we all spend our lives tying knots. And in a sense, that's true. But the meaning of a soldier's life or a nun's life or a doctor's life or a mother's life is, it's better than tying knots. That's all. And this is not something that Orthodox economics acknowledges. Just as well, or I needn't go into the technicalities. But look, humans are above all speaking. We talk. That's what we're doing right now. Conversation. Now, birds and other animals can signal to each other. Even plants signal to each other, apparently. But that's not speech. That's not a conversation where... And the great thing about real conversation, as opposed to me spending 2 hours telling you what to think, is that it's creative. That in the space, I'm always thinking of it this way, in the space among us is an object that all three of us are working on at the same time. And if we actually listen to each other, the old root proverb is that there's a reason God gave us two eyes and two ears, but only one mouth.
This ties nicely back to the work of the academy that we are representing in this podcast here, because the philosophy is to nurture the thinking through conversations in the seminars that are held at the International Academy for Leadership.
Yeah, and if I'm an economist, I've been interested in entrepreneurship all my professional life. My earliest work in economic history was on English entrepreneurship in the iron and steel industry in the late 19th century. And I talk about it all the time. I finally got it clear in my mind from Israel Kirzner, the great Austrian economist who ought to get the Nobel Prize, but never will, that it's essentially creative. Now, what I've said to Israel is, yeah, it's essentially linguistic. Mm. It's the persuasion that you do to yourself when you talk it over. Now, let's see, should I do this? Should I do that? And the persuasion of customers, employees, bankers, that's the next step. Of alertness, as Israel calls it. You see an opportunity. Well, okay, you've seen the opportunity. Now what? So that we're human talkers, that we form our worlds with words. There's a great short German poem by Auslander was her name. She's a German-American poet. Where she starts with the opening words of the Hebrew Bible. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and blah, blah. And then takes off and says, and the world we create with language is our Traum, our dream, and we live in our dreams. And that's so true of all of us. It's not crazy or somehow French or, you know, postmodern or something. It's just common sense that our world is fashioned by speech. And that doesn't mean we just have to accept it. We can criticize the metaphors that people use. For example, the metaphor of the family, the metaphor now, not the institution itself, but the metaphor of the family is an extremely dangerous one if it's applied to the whole society. Then the king becomes the father of the nation, or the Communist Party becomes the mother. And I have an essay on this about in praise of the family as a where the analysis should probably start thinking about the economy instead of absorbing the wife's utility function into the husband's, which is what my former colleague Gary Becker liked to do. No, she's got to utility function too, Gary, if you want to know, talk that way. Their marriage, if it's a good marriage and a good household where the children are learning well, is a conversation. And it's a good conversation about ethics, about how to behave, and how to have a good life. It's the Michelle Obama family. But to use that metaphor for Alva and Gunnar Myrdal running your life from their offices in Stockholm because they're the mommy and the daddy.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Suddenly my brain feels a little bit smarter after this conversation. It was an amazing, always listening to you and reading your work has always been very, very inspiring in terms of new ways of thinking about situations, new ways of looking at currently our understanding of history in general. I think you've great contributions. Thank you so much for giving us your time today.
I've enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
It's been a creative conversation.
Indeed.
Yes. Thank you. So that was, like I said, it has made me feel smarter, Rainer. I think one of the key takeaways for me from this conversation is in terms of how we look at explanations of human prosperity. There are so many smaller narratives, I think, that focus on very, very small things. For example, the idea that there is a certain investment that is required, that institutions are important, and so on and so forth. So sometimes we are so focused on the nuts and bolts that we forget to look at the larger picture of the machine. We forget to look at what is driving all of these forward. And that is this idea that if you leave human beings alone, that is what brings about this, you know, innovation, this creativity. That is what actually brings forward human flourishing, the way we think about it. So I think that in all of McCloskey's work, for me, that is one key takeaway that I have.
I fully agree, Apita. I mean, what a humbling conversation, because you could go in any direction at any time with all this knowledge that she has. And I agree. I mean, development, growth, progress, whatever you want to call it, is nothing but a chain of cause and effects. And if we look at a later stage of that chain where things are already effects and become causes in themselves, we can analyze the importance of transportation for human development. We can talk about trade. We can talk about so many things. But there's some underlying cause, and she has this ability to bring it back to a very simple cause, which is what she calls innovism. It is not capitalism, market economy. It's innovism. It's just the idea that people need to be able to innovate on a personal level, and then with others together, let it emerge into something new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And to me, the other thing about what we explored was another key takeaway was just how we think about character building. It also, at the end of the day, it boils down to leave the family alone in terms of developing character, because as she rightly put it, it happens on a mother's knee. That is where character is built. But in terms of looking for meaning in life, we keep looking for these extra solutions, external solutions. And I think sometimes that is a dangerous path in itself to go down.
Is true, yet in her view, as she says, she's not an anarchist. So there need to be rules that prevent crime, that prevent violence. So while this authority absolutely rests with the individuals, with the families, with the mothers, there needs to be a level of protection that ensures that people are not violated in the process, because sometimes traditions are violent, sometimes families are violent. So there is the necessity for a justice system, which she absolutely accepts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very key point. Having said that, it is, I think, when we try to institutionalize these character building institutions and say everybody needs to follow, this is the moral code, is I think where we are going wrong, at least in from the conversation. That is what I took away.
I found this so interesting because, I mean, this entire complexity is not just economic growth. We even talk about religion. And here the parallel lies that while you want the economy or society to have its own rules, its own bottom-up growth of rules and regulations with minimal interference from the top, you have the similar thing at the religious level where you have values and cultures evolving bottom-up, which carry Islamic, Christian, Judaic, or other religious beliefs which are necessary for the order of the society, for the well-being of the individual. But you have an interfering top that comes in through religious leaders, through hierarchies in the religion, which are necessary but should also be kept at a minimum so that people, again, are able to live their traditions but also evolve. And this is what we often see, that the evolution is actually hindered by those who try to control.
Yeah, and then I think like it brings us to this one key takeaway I had is the importance of conversation, of active listening, of listening to each other. And we create something beautiful in having a creative conversation. It is the start of a new idea that comes about. And that is what really brings together, brings about human flourishing. It's this ability to have this conversation.
And I felt for me that was ultimately the beauty of the conversation, because we started so broad. We talked about why did the, as it's called, the great enrichment or the prosperity that evolved, why did it evolve in the Northwestern Europe? There are explanations that this had to do with Protestantism, racism, colonialism, you name it, mercantilism, you name it. There are so many different ways of looking at it. She has her own contribution to this discussion. And you go and then talk about value systems, you talk about traditions, you talk about so many things. But at the end, our conversation also boiled down to this very simple idea that I think very many people understand and agree with. It's the freedom to develop ideas, to actually share these ideas, the respect that we give each other to listen to each other, to listen to these ideas, which is basically just my thought process, my conversation with another person, and that we trust that we are doing this together in order to build a better world. And I believe this is what not just, I mean, human development looks like, but this is what every seminar we do at the International Academy for Leadership try to instill and try to practice in our seminars.
Well, with that pitch plug, thank you very much for listening to this episode of our podcast. I really hope you enjoy it. And for these kind of very, very interesting conversations, do come back to listen to our podcast again and again. Thank you.
Thank you.